Listen up. I hate to have commercials interrupt this interview, so I'm going to tell you about three sponsors quickly now, and then we're going to go right into the program, starting with Walker Corporate Law. If you need a lawyer who understands the startup world and the tech community, I want you to go to walkercorporatelaw.com. Next, I want to tell you about Shopify. When your friend asks you, "How can I sell something online?" I want you to send them to Shopify and explain to them that Shopify stores are easy to set up. They increase sales, and they'll make your friend's products look great. Shopify. Finally, I want to tell you about Grasshopper. Do you want a phone number that people can call and then press 1 for sales, 2 for tech support, etc., and have all of the calls be routed to the right person's cell phone? Well, get your number from grasshopper.com. All right, let's get started. Hey there, freedom fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. How does a founder who's miserable at his job create a multi-million dollar company? Martin, and I'm going to try the name and then he'll get it right with me. Martin Bierod. You say it, Martin.
Yeah, thanks, Andrew. It was a good attempt. in Danish, it's going to be Bierod. But I've never heard any American being able to say that, so I definitely appreciate what you just said.
I wanted to at least try, and I definitely, as I told you before the interview, wanted to get it on the record properly, because I imagine somebody who's on his way over to get a job with you or raise money from you is listening to this interview. I want them to hit the rewind button a couple of times and at least hear you say it so they can practice.
It's an unfair challenge, but okay.
So Martin is the founder of Frokost.dk. It's Denmark's leading food portal, and it has millions in revenues, as I mentioned earlier. I'm going to ask him to get a little more specific about the revenues in this interview. And why don't I tell you a little more specifically what the company does? Basically, if you have an organization and you need lunch for all your people, you go to Frokost.dk in Denmark, you order lunch, they have it delivered, everyone can sit down and eat together instead of having them all run out around noon or 1 o'clock to get their own lunches separately. That's what the company does, and we'll hear how he built it up in this interview. We'll also find out that he is the author of Winning Without Losing, an upcoming book. Actually, it's been published in Europe, it's been big in Russia, and soon will be here in the US. And he's running several companies, including Rainmaking, which turns ideas into businesses, and Startup Bootcamp, a European accelerator. Martin, thanks for doing this interview.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, Andrew.
The time that made you say, "I need to stop," well, what was the job that you spent 15 miserable months in?
It was as a management consultant at McKinsey & Company. And it's no critique of them. It just was a bad fit with my personality. But I definitely learned something, not necessarily to be an entrepreneur, but I learned to endure long hours and basically hated it.
And the time that made you say, "Hey, I got to get out of here," is when you woke up in a strange place. Where did you wake up?
I was stationed in Kuwait City. And I've been there for a couple of months. I had my girlfriend back in Copenhagen, I was quite junior, and I've been made responsible for a work stream. I think that was their way of testing if I was ready to, you know, be promoted a small step on the long ladder there. I guess I wasn't really up to the task. I felt it was a bit boring. It was a huge piece of analysis, industry analysis, and a long, long PowerPoint that needed to come out of it. And it wasn't, you know, really what I had dreamed of doing. And it came to a point where I was just sitting alone with this huge analysis, this huge file, and all those numbers and spreadsheets and market research and interview with experts. And then suddenly I just couldn't sleep anymore. And I was at the Marriott Hotel in Kuwait City. And I was just walking around there during the night, because when you lie in your bed, at least when I lay in my bed for 3 hours, then I just couldn't stand being in the room anymore, looking up in the ceiling. So I started walking around the hallways and found a couch and I sat down for a while. I got up again, I found another couch. And then I half fell asleep on a very soft, high-quality couch at Marriott. and and, and, and And then I was suddenly looking up, and there was some staff member standing there and said, "Are you okay, sir?" And I had to admit to myself that actually no. And then I made after that had been going on for some days, and when you can't sleep it, when I can't sleep anymore, then it goes quickly downhill. So after 3 or 4 days, I needed to make a decision, and I decided to simply call back home in Copenhagen, ask for the HR manager, which was the person responsible for that kind of issues, and I told her, "I'm sorry, but I will need to quit." And she said, "Well, can you just come back home and we'll talk about it? We'll find something for you here in Copenhagen. There's no reason to overreact and things like that." And I said, "I totally, appreciate and respect your attempt to get me to reconsider, but I really need to sleep. And in order to do that, I simply need you to accept the fact that I am quitting." I just the message in person. I'm going to send an email now, and it's done. And that was necessary, because after that, I just went up to my room and I slept as a baby. So wow. It was definitely the right decision.
I can't imagine actually just sleeping in the hallway on some couch at the Marriott and having a coworker find me, especially when you're that far away from home and when you're working at McKinsey, which gives you all this prestige. So here's this guy with all this prestige is now sleeping like a homeless man at Marriott's couch. But I understand it wasn't the job for you. And what we'll see is the next place was a huge step forward for you. And then you launched this company that we're here to talk about in this interview today. And what people who hear that story are going to wonder is, what was this guy doing at McKinsey? And you went there for a specific reason, because you had a problem. What was that problem?
I started my first business when I turned 18, because in Denmark it's possible to legally start a company when you're 18. And on my 18th birthday, I filed the papers and got my company, at least in a legal way. And I've been waiting for that, because I already kind of started a little bit on the side. So it was really good to get it on paper as well. And I think the reason I started so early on was that my dad was an entrepreneur. I've been helping him for as long as I can remember. So I was really excited about getting my own company already then. And then during the next 5 years, I tried to launch 5 different companies. I, a couple of times, got it up to around 10 employees. But then each time it started falling apart. I was probably quite okay at working on my own, but I was a terrible manager, a terrible leader, I think. And also the strategy was not very sharp, if it ever is. But I can definitely see today that there were a lot of mistakes being made there.
Well, I made an example, because I know that there are a lot of people in my audience who hit some, I guess we all do, we hit some ceiling beyond which we think we can't break. Maybe it's we get to $100,000, but for some reason we can't get to $500,000 in revenue. Maybe we get to 1,000,010 people, but we can't break any further than that, no matter how much we try. For you, when you got yourself at an early age to a ceiling of roughly 10 employees and you couldn't break through that ceiling, what was the problem? What was, in retrospect, holding you back?
It's a really good question. And I think it was my personality wasn't right at the time. It isn't.
Sorry,
for most,
it was
18-year-olds. But my personal maturity. I was a quite young and very ambitious guy, but also an insecure guy in many ways. And I couldn't see that there was anything else than maybe work in people's lives. And I simply couldn't understand when my staff had to pick up children, or when they didn't prioritize our venture as much as I did. And I guess I was, there was many good reasons to leave me. If you were an employee.
I see. You're saying, hey, you were really passionate about your business. You didn't understand why everyone else who worked for you wasn't equally passionate. If they wanted to go and pick up their kids, or go see a kid at a recital, or even maybe go to take the kid to the hospital, not the hospital, but the doctors, you said, hey, do that in your own time. Why aren't you focused like I am? And no one wants to work for a boss who doesn't care about them. And that's essentially what was going on.
Exactly. And also, if I wanted to get a message across, I think it could, I hadn't the communication skills to do it in a good way. So
do you have an example of how you did it in a bad way?
What we did in one of the companies was we sold toys to kindergartens, mm-hmm. Daycare centers and stuff like that. And we had some salespeople on the road. And I was a pretty good salesman myself. So after a while, I hired someone to also do it. And then I, I took a ride with them and observed them and gave them feedback. And I know for sure today I will have given that feedback differently, because I'm quite sure that what the experience was to get a lot of clever advice from an 18-year or 19 or 20-year-old guy who was pretty arrogant and didn't, you know, really know that much, especially not about life. So I can see if you were 30 or 40 years old, how that could have been, you know, an experience where that's not particularly motivating. So I think it's very important if you are a leader today that you can, you know, lead in a inspiring way and in an insightful way, in a human way. And that's really, as I evaluate myself, where there has been the biggest change, that today people can actually, you know, trust me to be reasonable, to be fair, to be respectful. And that wasn't necessarily the case when I was in the very early stages of my career.
I see. All right. And so now I understand you go to McKinsey, you get that sensitivity for dealing with people, because McKinsey people, well, you tell me, are they good with are they diplomatic? Is that where you learned how to connect with people?
They are diplomatic with clients, very diplomatic, you know, really, really good at client communication. And internally, they are not that diplomatic. they're not great people managers. And that's also what often goes wrong when a McKinsey person gets to be a leader in some organization. Sometimes it works fine because they are so clever that they can even adapt to that new situation. But also in a lot of circumstances, it goes wrong, even though they are so clever, but because they can't handle with the people issues. So I would definitely say that internally, McKinsey is not a great example of leadership. There's a saying that it's very easy to be a leader at McKinsey because they say jump, and the staff ask how high, and that's just very different from a normal company where right. people should maybe say why. So I wouldn't say that they're good at people management at all. But I think the most important thing was that I got to have a boss myself. I actually got to try 3, 4, 5 different bosses during my McKinsey time. And that was just extremely important because I learned how it was to be on the receiving end of that relationship. And I had no clue before, but actually I found myself to be pretty sad if my boss was just, you know, a little bit insensitive with me. And I learned that way in a very real way that maybe I should become a bit better when I'm the boss.
Okay. All right. And then you quit McKinsey, as you talked about earlier, and you end up going to work for a company that I said helped change your life. What was that company?
It's called Meyer Group. It's a Danish chef called Claus Meyer. He owns half of Noma, which has been named the world's best restaurant 2 years in a row now. 2 or 3 years in a row now. It's an amazing restaurant here in Copenhagen. He also owns a kind of a food empire where they have canteens and delis and bakeries and cooks, chefs, tools and all kinds of things. At the time it had grown rapidly from 25 million Danish in 2000, up to 100 million Danish in revenue in 2004 when I joined. So it's been, you know, very successful. But also it was an organization with kind of no business people.
And that's why they wanted you. They said, McKinsey, great background, we want him.
Yeah.
And they brought you on board, and soon after you discovered a problem. Somebody bought a catering kitchen. Why was that a problem?
Claus Meyer, he has a principle of owning a lot of his businesses together with other business partners. And he was owning a company who were running canteens together with a guy called Klaus Tingström. And Klaus Tingström, he was quite independent, and he just bought a catering kitchen to deliver lunches to companies instead of running in-house canteens, which was the strategy of the company. And the board got a bit upset with that, especially that he didn't ask them. And Klaus Meyer, his partner, also got a bit, you know, upset about it. But anyway, he was very important because he was the CEO and he ran the company, and Klaus didn't, and the board didn't do much, so they just had to accept it. at the end of the day. And I was working across the companies, and we agreed that I should try to help fill that kitchen up with customers now that we had it anyway.
Let me see if I understand this. What do you mean by a canteen? Maybe it's a language issue, but this, what kind of kitchen was this?
It's not a restaurant. It's a big production kitchen where you make meals for maybe 500 or 1,000 people, and then drive it out to the companies.
I see. And then companies at their lunchrooms have the food that was driven out to them from the kitchen. Is that how it works?
Exactly. Yeah. I think it's a bit a cultural thing, because that model is very normal in Denmark. That if you work in a decent office, then the company takes care of the lunch. Either if it's a company with more than 100 employees, most often they will have their own in-house canteen. But if they have fewer than 100, then it's the financial probably won't work out. So instead, they get the food from an external supplier.
Okay. There's a company here in San Francisco that does that. I met one of their employees at dinner once. It's called Zero Cater.
Yeah.
And what they do is they give a company a menu of local menus from local restaurants. They pick what food everyone should eat, and then Zero Cater comes and delivers it. Okay, so what happened was you said, hey, there's this opportunity here. We have this kitchen that we shouldn't have bought. We need to fill it up with chefs, and the reason that with cooks. Well, actually, what did you need to do with it? I shouldn't explain it off my notes.
Yeah, we had cooks. We needed to fill up with customers.
Customers.
Yeah.
So it was individual cooks who were working for you or working for themselves and renting space from you?
No. We owned a kitchen, and we had hired some chefs.
Gotcha.
And we had a capacity of somewhere between 500 and 1,000 meals a day. We just had the problem. We were only serving one third of that or something like that. And Klaus Tingstrom, he had bought the kitchen, but he wasn't that aggressive a salesman. So thinking that he was a bit more patient than maybe the board was in terms of filling up that kitchen with customers so we could make money on it. So we agreed that I should have a look at that. And I just started a sales effort and quite quickly filled it up with customers because it was a good product and there was a lot of customers out there. It wasn't that difficult. But then the challenge was a few months later when the customers started quitting and finding new kitchens, new restaurants. And I did some exit interviews and said, so why are you leaving us? Have we done anything wrong? Is the food bad? Was it too late or anything? And they actually said, no, you did everything fine. We just need to try something new.
Just new and, kind of food.
Yeah, a new kind of food. And I said, okay, but we can change the menu. We have a chef who can do Mexican on Monday. But the problem is that all chefs, they have, even though they try to vary the food a lot, it can still sense it's the same guy doing it. So they just needed to try something else. And I thought that made a lot of sense, because when I go to a restaurant or then I don't want to go the same place all the time. I want to try different things. And why should that be different with your lunch? So I felt it made perfect sense. And when I looked into how the market dynamics is, then I found out that almost all customers switch within 6 months. So we have this industry where there are tons of restaurants, tons of kitchens delivering to tons of customers. And they all need to establish a new relationship every 3 to 6 months. And
they're willing to do that because their employees are so bored with the food that they need to switch, and find a new kitchen.
Exactly. Yeah.
I see. And you discovered this because you were doing exit interviews, because when someone quit, or someone said, hey, we're going to cancel our relationship with you, you called them up and said why, and you understood their issue.
Yeah.
Okay. And then an idea struck you. The idea that was the golden idea. What was it?
The idea was to make a network of kitchens instead.
Okay.
I didn't know exactly what that would look like, what the legal structure of that would be. But I just thought that let's have a shared office with some employees who make sales and customer service on behalf of many kitchens, so that the kitchens, anyway, they are good at making the food. They're not really good at talking to customers, to do invoicing, to do sales, marketing, branding, all those things. We, on the other hand, are quite good at that, and it's something that I feel comfortable about, and I think that I could make a difference in this industry. So to just allow the chefs to focus on what they're good at and split up the value chain, and basically. So we introduced a new role in the value chain. And I know that normally it's popular to take away roles in the value chain these days, but we actually introduced a new layer there. So we came in between the kitchen or the restaurant and the customer, the company who bought the lunch. Normally that had been a direct relationship, but I thought that let's go in and be a middleman there and a facilitator of that. And we'll take a cut that's going to be our revenue model, and then we're going to buy from a lot of kitchens. So if you're a customer at our company, you can choose from a lot of different restaurants. So you can really get your Mexican on Monday, and it's going to be from a really Mexican chef. And then you get your sushi on Tuesday if you want to, and sandwiches Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday.
And it's all done by specialists. You're not getting the guy who makes Mexican food to make you sushi on Thursday. Yeah. Now, when you took this to Klaus Meyer, what was the response?
He said that I'm not put in this world to be Mr. 5%.
Why? Well, what does he mean by 5%?
He meant that he said, how are we going to make money on this? And I said that we're going to take a cut. I don't know exactly what that should be, but we're going to take some percent for handling this. So it's kind of, yeah, it's a trading company, or it's a middleman model, or what you should call it, and he didn't feel that was his role in life. He's very passionate about producing the best olive oil in the world, finding a way to make the best apples in Denmark possible, and so he's very much into gourmet, the world of gourmet, mm-hmm. and make the best products, give people peak experiences with food like Noma does. And that's what he's passionate about. He's not all about making money, or not at all.
Okay. But you take this idea to him, he shoots you down, very noble reasons why he says no way. What's interesting to me, and we haven't even gotten to the company that you launched, what's interesting to me is what you did when you heard no. You didn't just say, damn, good idea, maybe I should hold off and do it some other time, or come up with another idea, or focus on my work. You instead went to someone else.
Yeah, I think that's been that way for good and for worse in my whole career. That when I have something that I'm passionate about, no one can say no. Only myself, or of course reality. Reality kicks in sooner or later. So a lot of times I have been fighting with something, and a lot of people have said that's a bad idea or no or something, and I've just been keeping going at it. But after a while, of course, if I don't get any positive response from the real world, then I have to back off. This situation, the first problem was Klaus. And what I did was that I spoke to Klaus Tingström, the chairman of the board. The chairman of the board, he was kind of, yeah, it might be a good idea, I don't really know, but if Klaus says no, we probably shouldn't pursue it. But he wasn't completely against it. And then I talked to Klaus Tingström, and that was an example of that it's good to try many different entries, because he liked the idea. He said, yeah, that's a great idea. And if Klaus Meyer doesn't want it in his company, we can do it here in my company, which they own together 50-50. But there was a history of that Klaus Tingström could make his own decisions.
I see. So you can now take your idea, partner with his partner who had a kitchen, and get started.
Yeah, exactly.
And you own what percent of the business, and what percent does he own of the business?
We made a model where Klaus Tingström owned 25%, I owned 25%, and Klaus Meyer owned 25%.
Okay. So even though Klaus Meyer didn't like this idea, he still ended up with 25%?
Yeah, because I didn't want to do this against his will together with his business partner. But based on Klaus Tingström's interest in the idea, I went back to him and said, Klaus Tingström likes it. The board likes it, which not, you know, at least they're not against it. And I really, really want to do this. And I want to have you in the business so you can make money on it as well. Okay. And I'm not going to, you know, require a big investment from you or anything, just your, you know, your blessing. And to sit in your office and be able to be, even though not by name, then a part of this group.
So he got 25% of the business just for a little bit of investment and a lot of credibility.
Yeah, it did help me a lot. You know, the first person I hired, Tanya, she was extremely important for the business. I couldn't have done it without her. And she came in because she was attracted to Meyer Gruppen. So to this brand. So we had an inflow of talent, and I grabbed the best of that talent for my company.
I'm sorry, Martin. I want to make sure that I understand the percent. So Klaus got 25. The other Klaus got 25. You got 25. Did I miss a 25 somewhere?
Yeah, the last 25 was distributed between Tanya got some, and some people we needed to make happy to make this happen got some. So the chairman of the board got some, 5%, and it was a bit funny. It was just to make it possible.
Everyone who knew you got a percent of the business. Did the guy who woke you up at the McKinsey couch, did he get a percent?
No,
not that person.
But to make Klaus Meyer happy, we had to give 5% to his chairman, because the chairman was asking for equity in the mother company, and Klaus was reluctant to give him that. That was kind of a problem. So this solved a problem for Klaus, and that was part of him allowing me to do it.
I see. He said, "I can't give you percent in my big business here, but I can give you in Martin's new company, and we'll see where that goes."
Exactly.
Okay.
So chairman of the board got 5%, and Klaus Tingstrom, he then also had a guy, his right hand at this canteen company. He was also asking for equity. He's been there forever, and he wanted equity, and Klaus Tingstrom didn't want to give it to him. So Klaus Tingstrom saw what Klaus Meyer was doing, and he said, okay, then put aside 5% for my guy as well. And I was just, yeah, okay, whatever. I need to get started. So I did that, and also those people helped us, of course, more than they would have done if they didn't have any equity. So it wasn't completely useless. And then I was 5% for Tanya, and then we reserved 10% for a future CEO. Because I said from the beginning, I'm not going to be the CEO forever. I don't know how long, but I think it's important that we reserve 10% for a kick-ass CEO when I'm not going to be that guy anymore. So that was how we came to
it down. Yeah. Okay. Then you started to get customers by working the phones, right?
Yeah.
And you needed credibility because you wanted to be able to say, hey, we can do this. And what I thought was interesting was what you did to get credibility when you were just starting. Can you tell the audience what that was?
What I did to get credibility?
Yeah. I could tell the story. I love it. I see it in here in my notes. Why don't I tell it? This is such a good story.
Yeah, please do.
Okay, you call up a customer, and a customer, of course, wants to know that they're not going to be a guinea pig, especially when it comes to food. So you have to say, I have customers already, but you can't usually say I have customers because you just got started. So what you did was you partnered with three kitchens. One of them had 500 people that they were doing lunch for on a regular basis. So when you called up new customers, you were able to say, yes, we have experience. We do 500 people every single day, and we'd love to add your employees to that list and maybe make it 700 or whatever. How does that sound?
Yeah, it's about right. I think it's often difficult to be a startup, and you need to find ways to get credibility, right? And this was a way to do it without lying. And I did get a really good relationship with Three Kitchens going on, and suddenly we had three good brands on board, and we had those 500 that quickly turned into 1,000. And it was actually also the idea resonated with people immediately. So it did, of course, require a lot of cold calling and a lot of sales meetings. Of course it did. But at the same time, I would say it's not like it never seemed impossible. We always, you know, we did 10 sales meetings, we got 2 or 3 new clients, we did 10 more. And I used to be a salesman, so I was also quite comfortable at that role. And Tanya, she was just great with the whole back end of the business. She loved food. She went out to those kitchens and she made sure that the supplies were great. It's also some lucky things there. And because her boyfriend, he was great at building an IT system that he did for us for almost nothing in the beginning. So in different ways, we actually started this company with 125,000 Danish kroner and a small bank loan, so combined less than $100,000. And the first year we had revenues of 20 million Danish, some $3.5 million the first year, and 50 million Danish the second, and 80 million the third. So it was really a great start, and it felt amazing because after 5 years of kind of, you know, failures to some extent, or at least some really intense feedback experiences, and then them going to school and sitting there while the whole .com thing happened, I was just sitting with books while MySpace was made and stuff like that. that vanished almost again. But and then going to at McKinsey, I was so hungry for having my own startup at that time, and I got it, and it was successful. So that was amazing.
How long did it take you to make your first million in sales?
Million US?
US.
It didn't take long. It was half a year or something like
half
that.
Half a year.
Yeah, but it's also very different than from running an, you know, online community or something like that, because that's my latest venture was that I started up an online platform for charity, but as a business, and that takes a lot longer to get revenue.
Because the price of each lunch is higher than what people would pay for something on a daily basis online, and because you were serving so many customers.
Yeah, we were selling real goods that people are used to pay for, and it's subscription based. So when we got a customer with 50 employees, we were serving them every single day. So the problem was not to get revenue in this business. The problem was to become profitable because it's low margin. Our cut, we started taking 10% in the beginning. We've grown that to 20 over the years. But it is, in general, a low margin business. So you can see that even though we had a revenue of $3.5 million US the first year, we passed along 90% of that immediately. So we only had $350,000 to run our company. So the trick here was to get profitable, and that almost only happened. That happened 2 years ago, and today it has a solid profit, but it did take a while.
Today it has a solid profit. What size profit today?
It's 1 million, a little bit less than 1 million euro in 2012.
And what size revenue?
We have 13 million euros in revenue.
Let me ask you this. You went specifically for a subscription-based model, partially because that's the way the business was run in Denmark, but you could have changed it because you were changing everything. You didn't want to change subscription. I'm looking at Zero Cater's frequently asked questions page. From what I can see, they're not doing a subscription. Why did you decide to stick with the subscription? Why was it so important that you mentioned it earlier?
The thing is that in Denmark, the company pays for the lunch. That's very different from almost all other countries, which is also why we are having a hard time. We have had a hard time exporting this model. We only still in Denmark, right? And I would have loved to take it to other countries, but the model only works, at least the way we have seen it. It only works when the company is paying for the lunch. Because if each person is making individual decisions, then it's something completely else. Then it's what Zero Cater is doing, making a platform available for all employees. And one can buy a sandwich, another can buy a soup. It's a very different logistics. And then you have, then because even though we serve meals for 7,500 people every day, we only have 300 people that we need to relate to.
Of course, because it's 300 customers who are buying for all those end users.
Exactly. And it's very different to have a call center for 300 people than for 7,500 people who could call and say, my soup, you know, tomorrow, could I get a little bit more spicy? We don't have that problem. And that's why I think that we can become profitable, and it can be maybe difficult for companies like ZeroCater to get to profitability. I don't know, maybe they're very profitable already, but at least in a small market like Denmark, it needs to be run very efficiently.
Okay, we're hearing all the great things, and eventually it did take off, but there was a bump along the way. I'm so glad, by the way, that we do pre-interviews, because first I was able to, thanks to Jeremy's pre-interview with you, get that story about how you had social proof as soon as you called your first customer, how you were able to say, no, 500 people are happy. The other thing that I learned from the pre-interview is there was a period there where you were depressed. It happened around, what was it, 2009. What happened around 2009 that made you feel the way that I just described?
Yeah, you know, that was a big financial crisis.
Yep. And what happened to your business as a result of it?
Started a bit in the US, but it quickly came to Denmark. And and what happened was that that during 2009, people canceled their subscriptions. Companies canceled their subscriptions because they started laying off people. A lot of our customers are advertising agencies, architects, consultancy companies, and they all had to downsize. So when they maybe laid off the first 20% of their staff, and then they saw that there was also the lunch, and actually they could either fire two more people or cancel the lunch, then a lot of the companies decide to cancel the lunch. And so we had grown to a volume before the financial crisis of 6,000 daily meals, and we got down to at the lowest point we were at 3,600.
Wow.
And I remember the thinking that maybe, you know, the last person here will just, you know, close the door and turn off the light and we'll go home. But because if this continues for another year, then we will basically be out of business.
Nothing left.
Yeah.
You thought about killing yourself. How serious were you about it?
I think that's that's an expression. At least that's I didn't mean it seriously, but
take me to the thing that separates these interviews from something that you might hear in your college business class is that entrepreneurs are willing to get personal about what they went through. Depression is not an easy thing to talk about, but I've gone through it as an entrepreneur. There are people who are listening to us right now who are in that place themselves. Can you talk about what it was like for you?
Yeah, I think I was very lucky that at that time I was not the daily CEO of the business anymore. Mm-hmm. And that was very, very lucky, because I think what I said in the pre-interview to Jeremy was that if I had been the CEO, then I'd probably killed myself. Because even from a distance, it was very depressing to watch that company fade away. And I was doing another company at the time, which failed, and I lost a lot of investor money. So if you combine those two situations, that I'm there with my new company, losing investor money, having to lay off six people, and at the same time my existing company or old company is just bleeding seriously. Then it was in a lot of ways a quite depressing situation. Luckily,
well, before we get to the luckily, how did you react to that? What did you find yourself sleeping in more often? Did you find yourself watching more TV? Did you find yourself getting distracted by something else? What did you do?
It's a good question. I read a lot of books about happiness and personal development and things like that. So I think that's been great for me, because some people are able to figure out on their own, but I probably needed to read it in books that happiness is not depending on success so much. Even successful people can be unhappy, and life, it's what you make of it. And it's probably, you know, the simple stuff like taking a walk in the park and the relationships you have, and eating an ice cream, and I could still do that. So I think I just used what I learned from, and I've always had great friends and and family, and there's a lot of good things going on. And all the time I've been doing a lot of sports, which helps a lot. I think if you're depressed, then take a 10K run and run until your lungs are about to burst. After that, I promise you, you won't be depressed. Only question is if you can do it. But if you do it, no one after having 180 in your pulse can be depressed. It's just physically impossible because you set free a lot of endorphins, a happiness hormone, and you get so proud of yourself that you actually did it. So there's not really any reason to be depressed. Of course, the problem is if you, you know, can't get yourself to do it. I've never been that depressed. I always had I have some tools. One is, you know, getting drunk together with my friends. Another time is going to the movies with my wife, or nowadays playing with my daughter, or taking a run, getting a really high pulse, traveling. You know, I have a lot of good tools in my toolbox, and I use those tools to, you know, mentally survive during the hard times. Another thing I did, I stopped reading the newspaper. I stopped.
The ones that were reporting about the failure of Lehman Brothers and about the collapse of this bank and that country's financial crisis, because why?
It was depressing. There was a time where seriously, and I think it must have been the same in the US, but it seemed like all business people in Denmark, at least 95%, were sure that it was going to be like in the 30s again. that it will be completely terrible. And of course, I know and I respect that for some people it have been extremely hard, and maybe it still is, and people have lost their jobs, and it's, you know, definitely a serious thing. However, during the whole process, I have been I've been able to live my life and travel and eat and all those things. So it's mainly been a question of that you could have some for a lot of people, it's been a question of a mindset more than reality. All my friends, they have had they've had the same luxury life basically. And
you know what, too, Martin? A lot of people would say, "Hey, it's a mindset, so I'm going to try to work on my mind on my own." But what I'm noticing about the way that you did it was, you said, "It's a mindset, but I'm going to use running, an outside tool, to get my mind to change. I'm going to use drinks with my friends to change my mindset. I'm going to go out with my wife to change my mindset. I'm not going to try to do it on my own, but use what's outside of me." And the other thing that I notice is it's all the things that you might have considered sissy when you were starting out in business, in your first companies, and even in your book, Winning Without Losing, you say right in the early, I forget where it was, in one of the early chapters, you guys are going to call some of these ideas sissy. Don't. Listen. Pay attention. And then you continue talking to people about some of the, somewhat we might call the balance of life.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
Two other things happened. One, I hate to keep going with this bad part, but we have to go through the bad part too to understand how you
got
the business.
I'm happy to share.
You saved 5% of your business to get a kick-ass CEO. You hired a CEO. What happened?
And the first CEO we hired, he was a good guy, but we thought that we had. A company where we just needed someone to be good at people management and marketing. Mm-hmm. So we hired that. It turned out, however, that this, as we grew, became a huge problem. So people were sitting and waiting for their lunch, which was often late by half an hour or even 45 minutes. And if there's something that really pisses people off, it's to wait for their lunch. Our phones were, you know, jumping off, and our call center employees were getting hell, and we needed to solve that problem. And he tried to, but he couldn't. And it was an urgent situation. And he didn't have any skills in logistics. I simply hadn't seen that was that important skill, that the CEO needed to be an expert in logistics. So after 7 months, I had to ask him to come into the meeting room, and I had to, you know, to tell him the most respectful way I could that he was fired. It wasn't his fault, but it was just a bad situation for all of us, and that he actually had to go out, take his stuff, and go home. Not because I didn't trust him, but because I needed to quickly restore trust and motivation in the team. And that was just impossible as long as he was would be sitting there. And even though he would try to look happy, put on a happy face, even if he could try to do that, then they would, of course, see that it was fake. So he had to go home at once. And that was really a very difficult thing for me to do. And I thought long and hard about how to do it in the best possible way, because I know this is something that can actually give people scars for life. We just had to do it. And I had found a replacement for him already, which was also a bit weird because 2 weeks I was just out there looking for a replacement. And normally I'm all about openness, but this thing, of course, needed to be a bit below the radar, which I felt shitty about. But I found a guy so I could present him to the team a few hours after having the other guy go. And I think that was critical in that time because it was a difficult time to be an employee in the company there with all those angry customers. So I found another guy, and he was really good with finances and logistics. And he fixed the problem, that problem, but he gave us a new problem. And that was because he structured everything and put everything into boxes. And he wasn't very flexible with customers. He wasn't that interested in sales and marketing. So even he was great at fixing the current problem. But when he had done that, then he got a bit bored. And we also thought that maybe it's now time to get a more a growth-oriented person on board. Or not that the other guy wasn't growth oriented. He just wasn't, you know, he wasn't a salesman. He wasn't a marketer. He was something else. He was a finance guy and great at that. But so that we agreed with, and that was actually just a very nice process because we could just sit down and agree on this. And he got a great job offer from someone else. And he's a very skilled guy. So he moved on successfully in his career. And then we made a big bet that turned out to be very successful on the third CEO, and that was great.
And you never wanted to be the CEO of the company. Unlike Michael Dell, who stepped in, you said, "I can't be the CEO because."
Because it didn't feel right. I like to start up the company, but I really don't know, but I could feel it in my stomach. I felt it in my stomach. It doesn't feel right. It wouldn't excite me. I need to do something else. I really don't know why. I still love the business, and we own it in my company or the company I'm part of, Rainmaking, and we love it. And it's now turning in a good profit, and it's great, and it's growing. But I never felt right to go back and become the CEO of it.
In fact, you still own the company and you actually bought out your partners. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Klaus Meyer and Klaus Tingstrom, they didn't contribute. And at that time, they were not supposed to either. So it's completely okay. But what I didn't know at that time, which I learned since, is that it's really annoying to have passive partners. It's okay to have passive owners if they brought in a big check because you need money to launch a business, and everyone understands that you put on a valuation on a startup and then someone gives you some money so you can start, and you don't expect them necessarily to be active, and that's fine, that's part of the game.
So you're saying while the connection's catching up with us, you're saying it's okay to have passive investors, but not okay to have passive partners. And you understood that they were going to be passive from the start, but you realized as you continued, hey, that's not the right way to work.
Yes, it felt, and especially when I wanted to do Rainmaking, it became a problem because in Rainmaking, myself and three of my friends, we started this company factory. And we had Frokost.dk, and we had a couple of other companies that we owned in a little bit of different mix of things. And we decided, let's do this company factory, and let's put all our things together and be equal partners in it. So then I put in my 25% equity stake, but then suddenly I only owned a fourth of 25%. And the other guys did too. And we just felt that owning 25% is not a lot, when it's us who are supposed to run the company for years and when we are four guys to share.
So what did you say? How did you get your shares back?
We paid for them. and quite dearly. A fair price, I think, but we did pay a substantial amount for it. We went to the bank, and now we were four guys instead of just me. I don't think I could have borrowed that kind of money on my own, but we went to the bank and said we would like to make an offer to Klaus Meyer and Klaus Tingström because we are the ones running the business and we have great plans for the future. And they agreed to borrow us some money, and then we made an offer, and they said no.
And?
And then, you know, some hassling and negotiation, and I reminded them that, you know, that if I lost motivation in it, it could be a problem. And they reminded me that they could find another CEO if necessary. It was all in good, you know, in a good communication, but of course it is what it is. It's never easy. But in the end, we found a number that they were happy with. And we did the transaction, and that was really a happy moment for me, because up until then I only owned my minority stake, so that meant that everything had to be negotiated. All big decisions needed to be brought to the board, and those people were busy and distracted, and you know I'm all in favor of having good advisors. However, sometimes it can be a problem if a too young company has a too heavy structure, too heavy governance. So we wanted, after the transaction, we at Rainmaking, me and my friends, we were able to do basically whatever we wanted. We consulted, of course, with Tanya, who was our first employee and still a part of the team. But apart from that, we could do whatever we wanted. So meaning that the guys who know the business are making the decisions. And we made a new board, but we told them or asked them to be kind advisors to us. And they were, and that was fine.
All right. There's one great story from how you raise money that I've got to get to. But first, this company that you mentioned, you said it was a company factory, is how you describe Rainmaking. What does it mean to be a company factory?
It means that we get business ideas, we start them, we get customers, we hire employees, we build the companies, and eventually we are very open to exiting them to keep a flow in our portfolio. So we've been around for 6.5 years now, and we've done 15 companies where we have closed down 5 because they didn't turn out the way we hoped it for. We paid everything what we owed them, but we closed them down. We are running 7 right now, and we have sold 3. And today we are 9 partners. So the 4 of us have expanded with 5 more guys who have been, all of them have been working with us for years. So now the idea is that being 9 partners, we can run 8 companies. Each of us can run 1 company. And the 9th guy, he's a lawyer. So he, you know, keeps us out of jail, makes sure that everything is correct, and that we are at all times ready to actually, all papers are in good order, so we are at all times ready to go into an exit process if an opportunity.
So the idea is, instead of investing in other people's ideas, instead of incubating the way Techstars might or Y Combinator, say we have good ideas, we understand the market, we'll create the business, we'll invest in the business, we'll run the business, we'll sell the business.
That's been amazing. But actually, we did a little similar to Techstars and Y Combinator, which is the leading European accelerator, and that's called Startup Bootcamp. Because what we experienced was that a lot of people started coming to us like 3 years ago, 3-4 years ago, and we would like to do something with a lot of those people, but we would, but we wouldn't distract ourselves too much from our core businesses. So we felt that we needed a way to capitalize on that inflow of ideas and opportunities and great talent without distracting ourselves. And then we read in Fast Company, I think it was, I read an article about Y Combinator. I thought it was a great model. We looked into it a bit more. We found out that Techstars was something similar, but we liked the Techstars model better because they actually have the teams sitting there in Boulder, Colorado, and now also in other places, but they physically sit there together all day long for 3 months. And that was the kind of environment we wanted to create. So we invited David Cohen, the founder of Techstars, to Copenhagen. Luckily, he was very nice. He came, told us everything he knew. He has this open source philosophy as well. So he told us everything. And then we found, luckily I bumped into a guy, Alex Farset, an amazing guy who was out looking for a challenge in the Danish entrepreneur community and who also had read that article and loved the idea. So when we met, we agreed that we should do a Techstars in Europe. And that became Startup Bootcamp. Alex found that.
Let me just make sure that it's clear on mic. That's what Startup Bootcamp is. And the reason I say that is because you knew, you and I knew going into this interview that we might have some Skype issues. And every time you say Startup Bootcamp, it feels like there's a pause on that. So the thing that you said that I loved about how to raise money has to do with dinner. What can you tell the audience about this dinner and how it helps entrepreneurs raise money?
Yeah, I think we raised a lot of money, basically. Not that I'm particularly proud of that, but we did. and luckily, our investors have gotten a decent return in almost all the cases. So that's fine. But it is always a challenge to raise money. We've been so fortunate that we had some early successes, early exits. So we can normally take the companies at the first stage ourselves for our own money. But then at a stage, we take in co-investors. And that's normally business angels. And that's probably just because we're trying to step up our game a bit. So it's going to be VCs in the future. But for some reason, it started off being business angels. I like working with business angels because they are able to make their own decisions, so they can make fast decisions. And of course, the flip side of it is that if you want to raise €1 million or dollars or whatever, then you need to gather a group because they don't write as big checks as VCs. We raised a lot of money from business angels. And one thing that surprised me was that it's not about rationality so much. It's much more about that they want to get some good experiences out of it. And I think it makes sense because if you're like 60 years old and you have tons of money on your bank account, what motivates you in life is not to get 10, 20% more money. You know, everything that I can contribute will not be, in most realistic scenarios, it will not make a huge difference to that person's financial life anyway. They are home safe. They have a lot of money. So it's more to create some good experiences. And I think what you're referring to is that at one time I gathered a group of 9 people that was going to invest in us, one of our investment rounds. And the 9th guy, it was very difficult to just also get him to commit. And then I suggested that we could have the closing dinner at his restaurant. And then he responded to my email because I think it was a nice experience for him. I think he all the time he intended to make the investment, but he just needed the good occasion to respond to my email or my phone calls. And that was that I said, can we make the closing dinner at your restaurant? You know, do I have a good table for 9 people? And, you know, the other guys are also pretty cool. And, you know, are you up for that?
And you learn too, tell me if this is wrong, but from what I'm seeing from the notes, you learn that some people just invest because they want to get a chance to host the dinner or to get to know the other investors.
At least I think that first they need to tick mark the boxes of, have they done their preparation? Are they professional? Do they have, a track record in some? At least that help if you have a track record. They want to tick mark all the rational boxes. But then you need to put in something emotional as well if you want to get it there. And that can be, they can be proud of the startup. Maybe if you're featured in a big magazine or newspaper, that can be something. Now I'm going to invest.
I see. So you get them with the brains first, and then the heart is what gets them to sign.
Exactly. You need to get the brains. But in the beginning, I thought that it's enough if I'm just rational about it, make a good McKinsey-like presentation, and all the numbers add up, and I can defend my case and be confident, then they're going to invest. But I suddenly saw that, no, I need to throw in something emotionally, like a dinner or
all right. Let me just acknowledge what I've been holding in my hand here throughout this interview and ask you one final question. And I've asked people in the audience a small group of people as a test to send me mugs of their companies. And this one, because up until now I've been holding up a blank mug like this, and I said, hey, you know what? I'm drinking these mugs with all these entrepreneurs. Why don't you get me your own mug and maybe we'll help promote? So this one comes from Stefan Siwan Park. He is a PhD candidate in Vienna, Austria, and he runs something called Unconventional School, and he says that watching me do interviews on Mixergy inspired him to do interviews too, and so he started to do interviews. And I love to get to know the people in the audience. This is a reminder of who's out there, and I also love to see that people in the audience don't just watch my interviews but do their own interviews. If you want to, all the software that I use here is available online. I can give you the list here. You can check the help files if you guys are interested. But we also, for premium members, I have a course where I walk you through the process, where I show you how I find guests, how I get them to say yes, including the exact email that I send out that you're welcome to copy. And I wish that people who ask me to do an interview would use that email because it's so good. And the full process, the editing process, I think you can actually watch me edit the interview so that they're side by side. It's all in there. If you're a Mixergy Premium member, go to mixergypremium.com. And if you're not, I urge you to sign up and start doing your own interviews. I've learned so much from Martin, as you guys have, as you've watched me do this interview, and from the 800 plus entrepreneurs that I've been lucky to get to know. In fact, one of them is going to be over here later today just for some yerba mate, just for a drink. It's been more than just getting to know and learning from them. It's been great friendships. So I urge you guys to do it. And Stefan, I'm glad that you're doing it and that you sent me a mug. Martin, here's my question to you, related to what Stefan wrote to me. In your book, you didn't just say, I started this business, I've started other businesses, here's my process you guys should learn. In Winning Without Losing, your book, you did that. You taught what you learned, but you also said, hey, I'm going to bring in these other entrepreneurs like Jason Fried, like Tony Hsieh, like people whose names aren't as big, but whose ideas and their experience are equally important. Why'd you do that instead of saying, here are the 10 things that work for me, go do it?
I think that I've learned some things and I know some things, but what was really interesting was to go out and find a lot of people all over the world and interview them. Like you said, that you learned something from those 800 people you interviewed. That's an impressive number. We found 25 and we felt we learned so much. So I think that it would be both a bit lazy and a bit arrogant for me, like 36 years old, to sit down and write a book to the world about what I learned. Not to say anything about people who do that. I think that, you know, in some cases they are clever enough to pull it off. But we had big ambitions for the book. We wanted it to be an international bestseller. We wanted it to be something that could really inspire and help millions of people. We wanted it to be the ultimate business book for how to create a startup from scratch, something as challenging as that, or build an impressive career and at the same time live a whole and happy and balanced life. And we felt that we needed to, you know, learn from a lot of people who had those things, learn what they felt was difficult, how they found strategies that worked in their own lives, how they thought about the topic. And I think we just learned a lot and it made it a book.
Give me an example. What did you learn from interviewing these 25 people and using them as mentors that you didn't know before?
For instance, a very specific thing is that I've started doing a today list instead of a to-do list. And it might be a small small difference in letters, but actually the impact is just enormous. And we learned that from Mr. Muthi, who's the creator of Infosys. Mr. Muthi, he's a self-made Indian billionaire, the creator of Infosys, and he sits on the board of Ford Foundation and Stanford and very some of the world's biggest organizations and companies. And he told us on our interview that he had always, he seems extremely, you know, down to earth and calm, by the way, even though he has this ton of obligations and responsibilities on his shoulder. We thought that he must be very busy and maybe a bit distracted in the interview, but he was just completely present. And he told us that from the beginning of his career, he always thought, what's the most important things for me to do today? Not focus so much on these long plans and what do I need to do over the next, you know, year or 10 years, because you are just 3 months, because you can get overwhelmed by it. If you make a to-do list, or if I make a to-do list of everything we need to do, then it's going to overwhelm us, and our brains can't really separate what
so
needs to be.
Just make a two-day list. What do you want to get done today, and limit it to that?
Exactly. Then focus on that. Do that, and tomorrow make a new to-do list and just a to-day list, and all the time just focus on what do I need to do now, and also think about what in the morning, what or the evening before, if you prefer that, what would I perceive as being a decent day's work? Because the problem can be that we get into this never-ending workflow where you're never satisfied, because there's always tons to do as an entrepreneur in a busy career. There's always tons of stuff to do. So I think it's a really a favor to yourself to say, what's actually a good achievement today? And when I've done that, allow yourself to be happy, to be proud. You did achieve what you set out to do today, and go in tomorrow with full energy and do another to-do today list. And I think that's it's a small thing, but it has enormously impact for me. So I think overall, the book just turned out to be 10 times better than if Jordan and myself has just sitting it down and emptied our heads, because we're really not that smart. But combining all those great minds and moderating it and adding our own contribution, I think it actually turned up to be a pretty okay contribution.
It's a great contribution. And that's a good example of what's in the book. I'm looking through it here. Winning without losing through the table of contents. And it's, you've got list of empowering thoughts when times are tough. You've got new ways of doing old things, 5 adjustments with profound impact, 15 strategies to increase your efficiency exponentially. It's these ideas come from you, the 2 co-authors, and also from the mentors. And it's a great book. I want to make sure to mention it again, Winning Without Losing. And there's one other thing that I want to make sure to mention, which is you told me before the interview started, and I should have introduced it earlier. The meaning of Frokost is lunch. So it's basically like saying lunch. That's where the company Frokost.dk got its name. And thank you so much for sharing that story and telling us about the book and what else you're doing. You're going to say something?
No, I'm just going to say thank you for giving me the opportunity. I think it's been great. You asked some very exciting questions. So it's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks for doing this. And thank you all for being a part of it. Bye, guys.